everyone, and welcome to Literary Loitering, the books and arts podcast that was definitely in your room moving your stuff before you got in.
Just like Manson.
Manson?
Yeah, Charles Manson's family used to do that.
What, were they, like, movies? And okay, I'm confused
have
now.
Have I killed the conversation already?
No, you just managed to confuse me. I don't know much about Charles Manson's
fine,
family.
Ben. Charles would be proud.
I honestly don't know much about Charles Manson's family, so when you say that, I'm thinking, what, were they a family of, like, movers? Did they move people from house to house or stuff? And...
Yeah, they just got carried away in the later stages.
Anyway, those two are Graham and Rob. You can sort that out for yourselves, and I think that pretty much sets the tone for the show.
Yes, it does. So, we have news. We've got plenty of news.
Yes. What shall we start with? Should we start mildly serious?
Let's start with that book thing that you found about domestic dramas.
The judges for the Branford Bowes Award, which I've just found out about when I read that out, have made a comment about trends in children's literature. Philip Womack and his fellow judge Julia Eccles shares the Eccles. Have said that dramas based around family life or other personal circumstances are crowding out the traditional children's adventure story. Womack cites novels such as Mark Haddon's The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime and R.J. Palacio's Wonder as possibly setting the trend, but notes, in order to write this kind of narrative, you need to be very skillful. And I just think the problem is that publishers and authors maybe imagine that if you give a character an illness, they will be sympathetic. It's become a trope, something people should do because they think that's what a book should be. What authors should be doing is presenting readers with worlds the child can explore.
Yeah, I actually agree with that. I think that adventure books, they're a thing, they're an essential thing because it adds to playtime when you're a child. You imagine, you know, you can imagine you're in this world or that world or something like that. There's nothing greater as a kid than having an adventure.
Right. Look, I'm just saying, guys, if you didn't want to read my 1,000-page masterpiece, Sad Orphans with Polio, you could have just said.
I think, I mean, one thing.
Spoiler alert, in the end, the one who doesn't have polio is the one who dies.
It's such a twist. It's challenging all of my preconceptions about Sad Orphans with Polio.
See, that's what you could have got, but no. I'll just burn the manuscript instead.
From my perspective, it's basically...
And then write a new book about a struggling author with a dodgy back whose life's work was ruined by the callous children's publishers.
I mean, of course you've got a dodgy back if you're going to keep writing 1,000-page manuscripts.
Yep. From my perspective, I was just sick to death of reading Enid Blyton novels. And so when I got to read stuff like The Black Cauldron and The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe and stuff like that, where kids were actually going on proper magical adventures in different worlds and stuff like that, instead of, oh, look, there's a boat. Let's take it to that island. Let's just sit on this island for the day. Let's go home.
I think, I mean, one of the things that... it is probably driving this is the fact that books about quote-unquote serious issues are kind of what grown-ups think children's novels should be. I mean, I remember when I was a kid and Melvin Burgess came around and everyone was talking about, oh, he can write a book about drug addiction but make it suitable for young adults as if it was like the most incredible conjuring trick. And I just thought, well, I don't want to read that, to be honest.
No. I read Gormenghast when I was 12.
See, and that's an adventure.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I think Steerpike is such an amazing character. I was like, Titus is a nice guy and all, but this Steerpike, he's got something about him.
He's full of handy hints on how to get ahead in the workplace.
Yes, he is. I mean, his advice was mainly, if somebody is getting in your way, get rid of them permanently.
Yes, but, you know, that's good advice in its own way.
Yeah. So there is a lot you can learn from kids' adventure books.
I think so, yeah. But I think, sword. I mean, you have to say that authors like Jacqueline Wilson have proved that if you can do this right, kids will absolutely eat this kind of social melodrama up. Yeah. But I can easily believe that a lot of people are not doing it right.
Yeah, and I think that's my favourite thing about the story, is what they're really complaining about is, God, why are there so many crap children's authors?
Actually, yeah. Andrew, you can always rely on Andrew to cut right to the heart of it.
Yes.
I don't have anything to add after that.
No, I think that's pretty much packaged it up. Shall we move on?
Yes.
Yeah, let's.
Yeah. Anyway, over in southern France, a museum in Elne, they've had a bit of a catastrophe. The museum's dedicated to the work of painter Etienne Terrasse, and they recently discovered that at least 82 of the 140 artworks were actually fakes.
This is a tragedy, of course, because Etienne Terrasse is my favourite Serge Gainsbourg album.
That's just words to me. and I can never take anyone called Serge seriously.
Yeah, it's sort of... Well, we'll save that for the double entendre. Exactly.
Exactly. Especially after watching Beverly Hills Cop.
Right.
So, the Terrasse Museum in Elne had bought the paintings, drawings and watercolours over a period of 20 years for the total price of around 160,000 euros. So, obviously, this painter isn't that well known, but is now. Concerns regarding their authenticity were raised only recently after an art historian called Eric Forcada, who was entrusted with overseeing the entire Terrasse collection while the small museum was being renovated, he noticed some of the buildings depicted in the artworks had been built after the artist's death.
Fantastic.
That's good. That's even better than I expected, and I love a good art forgery story.
See, this is just brilliant. You have entire buildings that were built after the artist died, and yet the museum has them in as, yes, the artist's work, and nobody noticed.
I've got to admit, when I last went to the National Portrait Gallery and saw Dante Gabriel Rossetti's classic painting of Lizzie Siddle going for a McDonald's, I did get suspicious.
Yeah.
But just look how the light dapples off those golden arches.
Yes.
Truly a masterpiece.
The pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood could capture a Cadbury's Crunchy McFlurry like no one else, don't get me wrong.
This is true. The buildings that weren't supposed to appear in these artworks led the art historian to more unusual discoveries. On one painting, the ink signature was wiped away when he passed his white gloves over it.
He voted on in glittery marker pen or something.
He goes on to say, at a stylistic level, it's crude. The cotton supports do not match the canvas used by Terrasse, and there are some anachronisms. I think a building that wasn't there, that was built after he died, is a huge anachronism.
Yeah, it feels a bit polite even to call it an anachronism rather than...
We all thought Terrasse's felt pen period was a bit odd.
That's great. I absolutely love Art Forgers. Has anyone ever seen Orson Welles' film, F for Fake?
Yes.
Yeah. I think that's what made me love Art Forgers. I just love watching Elmer de Hory basically sketch out a Matisse in about 15 minutes.
There's been some fantastic art forgery stories, but I think this one is among the best, just for the fact that nobody noticed for all this time.
I mean, the sheer lack of effort that the forger is putting in is sensational, isn't it?
Yeah, and that makes it even more surprising that nobody noticed.
Oh, God, I hope it's the same guy who's done all of them. Like this one man who keeps ringing in the museum. Would you believe it? I've just so happened to stumble across another Etienne Terrasse original. Really, Francois? Because this makes 63 that you've found this month alone. What can I say?
I'm just a huge fan of it.
Incidentally, it's right next to the Madonna with the big boobies.
Oh, fantastic Allo Allo reference.
Because this is like a Allo Allo plot.
It is. Moving from one set of paintings to another, a 40-year-old man allegedly travelled almost 10,000 miles from England to an art gallery in Aspen, Colorado, where he used a sharp object to slash a $3 million painting by New York artist Christopher Wool before storming out. Right? Now, okay. normally you'd think, oh my God, it's a $3 million painting. He's attacked it with a knife. He's attacked it with a blade. It's worthless now.
I think you find sharp object. So for all we know, it could be a rusty spork.
Yeah, it could be a rusty spork.
It could be a ballpoint pen.
Yep. The painting is called Untitled 2004. He took a knife or other cutting object out of his jacket, it doesn't specify what it was, and slashed the painting twice before running out of the gallery. A one-year investigation recently revealed the man who carried out the slashing was a guy called Nicholas Morley, who, it turns out, is... Well, here's how it goes. He damaged the painting, and the police were investigating the guy who damaged the painting, and then they were contacted by the owner of the painting, who basically said, look, it's all right, don't worry, the painting can be repaired, everything like that. It's only a minor incident. Play the whole affair down as over-enthusiastic reporting by local newspapers, everything like that. Yeah?
Yeah.
Because the owner of the painting is called Harold Morley, who is Nicholas Morley's dad. Harold Morley is a former dentist turned property developer, and obviously there's something going on there.
This is the most middle-class production of Oedipus Rex I've ever seen.
Exactly.
So he's vandalised a painting because his dad owns it, is what we're thinking.
Yeah. And Harold Morley, though, is looking at it from the pragmatic capitalist side. He's looking at it as, it's been all over the news, we could put it up for sale now for $3.5 million on the basis that it's famous.
Yes.
God, rich people are the worst, aren't they?
But that is dedication, isn't it? I mean, a lot of people have gripes with their parents, but travelling thousands of miles to value your parents' assets, so to speak.
Well, here's the best bit, right? And this just goes to show that Andrew is absolutely correct.
Mm.
On May the 10th, Nicholas Morley wrote to the gallery as well, saying that they didn't plan to hold the Opera Gallery liable for the incident, and added that it would appear, possibly based on the video footage, and is our judgment, that this was an accident rather than malicious damage.
Nobody travels thousands of miles for an accident.
Exactly. And he requested the gallery either issue a press release that the incident was in fact an accident, or issue no further press comments.
This is, you know...
Incidentally, our maid has just had a terrible accident where she's fallen down this flight of stairs.
This is like with Neil and I. I've gone on holiday and slashed a painting that my dad owns by mistake.
Basically, yeah.
Like, what did he... Oh, no. There's a nasty smudge on that wall. I'll try and scrape it off with my knife.
I'll just try and stab the painting clean.
My knife that I carried all over with me. It was with me through school, with me through college. It's my best friend.
It's my top knife. This is, I think, yes,
I actually have severe depression, and this is my therapy knife.
See, when we say it like that, it's starting to sound a bit like Sweeney Todd now.
Yes. Well, there's a whole history, isn't there, of people having bizarre reasons to damage paintings. Like, there was that Rothko that was defaced by someone who wanted to promote his own artistic movement. Surprisingly, I don't think many galleries have really taken him up on that.
Yeah, if you have to damage someone else's work just to promote your own, then you're not much of an artist.
Who should we have our new gallery show by? How about that guy who cost us millions? Yeah, that's a good one. My favourite was the guy who poured paint on Carl Andre's sculpture Equivalent 7, which is a minimal structure of 120 bricks laid on the floor.
Mm.
And the most fantastic thing is he was not stopped by security because nobody knew if it was part of the piece or not.
Art is just the worst, isn't it?
See, my favourite will always be the Japanese student and the unmade bed.
In many ways, he was the true artist confronting the most abject reality, wasn't he?
Well, he wasn't the only one, because a couple of them started, I think a couple of them started off jumping on the bed. So, yeah.
I think somebody should have tried to have sex in the bed and then complained about the hypocrisy when they were taken out. That bed was only exhibited because someone had had sex in it.
Yeah.
If anything, having sex in the bed would have increased the value.
Unfortunately, that doesn't...
Oh, but having sex in someone else's sex bed.
Yeah.
In Tracy Emin's sex bed, nonetheless. You might catch conservativism.
It's a bad case. I'm just saying,
if you're going to stab a piece of art, maybe make it that one.
Having sex in the bed, would that then be performance art?
I think so.
Which
certainly a performance.
Yeah, which kind of leads us on to the next bit.
Oh dear, we're going to have to do this, aren't we?
Oh no.
Not Eurovision yet. Not Eurovision yet. It's not Eurovision time yet.
Okay, but we have not yet reached the point where we are very generously overextending our definition of art.
Yes.
Well, actually, we are kind of overextending our definition of art, because you know what actors can sometimes be like, and you know what promoting things can be like, stage shows, movies, everything like that, right?
Of course, yeah.
Well, there's an Iranian film about a father and son who travel to Syria to deliver humanitarian supplies but end up kidnapped by ISIS.
Hmm. Yeah.
Sounds like an interesting film, yeah?
Yeah. Sounds like the best episode of The Archers ever.
Yeah. Unfortunately, because the film's called Damascus Time, and the director is Ebrahim Halamikia. The production company, the studio, everybody kind of got involved and went, okay, we have a great idea for marketing this, right? Let's have a bunch of actors dressed as Islamic State fighters and storm a shopping mall in Tehran. What could go wrong?
Me. Is it? Everything
yes. can
go wrong.
I mean, he's dressed as an ISIS guy riding a horse in a shopping mall.
Oh my God. So let's not jump to conclusions here. Rob, you've got the article. How was this received?
Not very well. A bunch of shoppers recognised the actors and realised it was only a stunt, but only after a lot of them had freaked out and run for their lives. Thinking it was a real attack.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Even if I did recognise them, I'm not sure my first thought would be, oh, this must be some kind of wacky publicity stunt. I'd possibly just run out screaming, oh dear God, Richard Gere has finally got, he's finally snapped. We all knew it was coming.
Here's a picture of what they look like.
Okay, let's have a look at this.
I think this picture was taken after everything had calmed down and they realised it's just a promotion, it's not an actual attack.
I cannot get to this because hot linking is not allowed.
Huh.
That is a shame because you are missing out on a spectacular ginger beard.
Let's see if I can get to it through the main article. Oh my God, it actually is Barry from Four Lions.
I know. It literally is. I read this and I was like, is this some weird Four Lions sequel that's going on? What's going on?
There was a publicity stunt, I think it was in China, for Iron Man 3, where they got people to pose as like armed fighters with rifles in the cinema. And that did not go down well, but evidently Iran saw that and went, hold my non-alcoholic halal beer.
Well, the Iranian authorities and a lot of the Iranian press have basically said, look, this was just wrong. Just who thought of this? And obviously, whoever thought of this is probably in a lot of trouble. I'm not saying they're going to get fired, but they're probably going to get firing squad.
Yeah, that's why would you even think of that?
Because people working in marketing are hellspawn.
Yes, this is very true.
I know this because I used to work in marketing.
Oh my god, I didn't even notice with the bit. He has a machete.
I know.
Maybe this is what they were banking on, that his majestic ginger beard was going to distract you from the implements of death he was carrying.
Or maybe this was the Iranian version of Childish Gambino's This Is America.
Ah, we had to get round to This Is America sooner or later, didn't we?
It was the beard that linked it.
See, we're culturally aware.
It was the beard that linked it together.
So you think we're going to get like a CNN explainer about what the ICE shopping centre stunt says about America?
No, possibly we'll get an American commentator talking about what it means for Iran.
What it means for Iran is, despite living in the crucible of the Middle East, they're still like scared if they see ISIS in their local shopping centre.
Yeah.
It can only burnish the image of Iran, I think.
Anyway, leaving Iran to one side, we have a book, or Andrew has a book.
Oh, that's what you mean by the book.
Yes.
Yes, hello, I'm going to talk about a book now. I was very prepared for this. Where am I? What day is this? What are my grandchildren going to visit? Sometimes the orderlies steal our jelly. Right, good, excellent. As we all know, only good things can come when I desperately try and ad-lib my way back to some degree of knowing what I'm doing. So yeah, I've been reading a book. I've been reading After Man, A Zoology of the Future by my favourite Marvel Comics character, Dougal Dixon.
See, I can't take anyone with the name Dougal seriously either, because Father Ted.
Yeah. Between Father Ted and the magic roundabout, that name's been killed.
Yes.
And that's not the only name that's been killed. Because also the names that have been killed, that all of them, because bad news, guys, humanity's dead.
Okay, so...
Oh, no.
What
but on the flip side, great news, humanity's dead.
Was that the cats saying that? Because I reckon it's the cats.
That's literally all of the life on Earth. So yeah, this is, it's basically a textbook of a speculative future of what life on Earth would look like 50 million years after humanity has died out. And it's super interesting.
Right.
Because it's basically this idea that, you know, it's 50 million years later, kind of, there's been a lot of continental drift, Earth's environment has kind of sort of gone back to pre-industrial times, so it's been split up into a bunch of different environments, which would say work as different chapters in a book.
That's handy.
So we have temperate woodlands and grasslands, coniferous forests, tundra and polar regions, deserts, tropical grasslands and tropical forests, and island continents.
Okay.
And yeah, it goes through each environment. Kind of giving a brief rundown of what the dominant species are, including little illustrations of what they might look like. So there's lots of stuff like one of the most common creatures on Earth is the rabbuk, which is basically a rabbit, which has evolved to look a bit more like a deer to basically fill that niche of a grass-eating ungulate.
What a great word ungulate is.
It is. It's such a good word.
That's my new Scrabble word where I get two U's and N and a G.
So never, then.
It's happened to me once. And I've been playing Scrabble for like 35 years.
Yeah, and so moving back to the book, like one of the things I really like just as an idea is sort of the dominant predator on land now is basically like an evolved form of rat. Which
that
is transformed into like a larger sort of wolf-like creature.
That does sound actually pretty accurate, because have you seen those giant rats you get now?
Yes.
They're terrifying.
Yeah, exactly. And like, that's the thing that kind of makes sense. is that, of course, rats are going to become like one of the dominant species because they can adapt to pretty much everything.
Well, they're already one of the dominant species. Aren't there supposed to be more rats than humans?
Yeah.
Is it weird that this book has made me like really appreciate rats just from like a scientific standpoint?
No.
It would be weird if the book had made you really want to destroy humanity.
Yeah, it would be...
Graham, that's not what kicked that off.
Yeah. It'd be even weirder if you suddenly started worshipping our alien rat overlords.
Again, he hasn't started.
It's just common sense to look at, you know, who's going to be the dominant species and how do I ingratiate myself with them earliest?
Yeah. We know the only thing that can overthrow an alien rat overlord is a cyborg alien rat overlord.
With a gun.
Yes. Or with laser teeth.
Laser teeth would be good, yeah.
Or with a motorbike from Mars.
No, they're not rats.
Yeah, that's right, mice. Everyone. Biker mice from Mars are back.
It's going to happen someday, isn't it? Michael Bay will make a big budget Biker Mice from Mars movie.
Guy who... Was it Michael Bay who did the Turtles? Or was it somebody else?
He produced them, yeah.
Oh, right, yeah.
He didn't direct, but he did produce. You can tell because Megan Fox was in them.
Ah, yes. His muse.
And yes, you can tell because whenever a trailer came on, there was a deep sense of existential sadness.
Anyway, back to the book.
It's really cool. Because I like there's kind of a prologue bit, which basically runs through sort of the basics of evolutionary biology.
Ooh, nice.
And like, I like that you can read that. And then you can kind of like flip it through the main book and realize that like, oh, like this is how this theory that Dougal Dixon, because I need to re-say that name many times, this theory that he's kind of laid out, this is how it would apply in like a real world circumstance.
Mm.
So like on the island bits, you've got lots of creatures that are all kind of very similar to each other.
Yeah.
But have evolved kind of sort of off in different branches to suit the various environments that they've wound up in.
So it's basically the Darwin's finches, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, like, it specifically makes mention to like the Galapagos Islands. That's a hard word to say, actually.
Galapagos.
Galapagos.
Imagine if they found a Diplodocus on Galapagos.
It's like they do, like you get bats, which just don't have eyes anymore.
Yeah.
Gigantic ears, which is such advanced sonar that they can now sort of sense things on a spectrum where eyes would be completely pointless.
So basically Daredevil.
Yes, Daredevil, but bats.
That's quite something. The urban vigilante superhero who has sonar power and no eyesight. Why is that not Batman?
He's got a good point.
Poor resource allocation there, I think.
He's got you there, comic books.
It's the obvious question.
Oh, also, I have a public service announcement.
Oh.
If at some point you time travel 50 million years in the future, stay away from the deserts.
Mongolian death worms, please.
Nope.
Is there something that's a bit
the
like...
The monkeys become the predators.
What?
Dun, dun, dun.
Like, there's like this one called the Horain, which is basically like a monkey that's evolved to hunt like in the desert. So it's got like this kind of striped sort of tiger-esque coat, but it's still got a monkey's head and it's all weird and gangly and I really don't like it. It's quite unsettling.
I thought you were going to go with the Tremors angle where you have these giant worms that burrow through the sand and then we find out that Arrakis is actually Earth all along.
What is it with deserts and killer worms? Why does everyone imagine that a desert has to have a killer worm beneath it?
Because the desert is it's fluid, a bit like the water when you get right down to it. A worm swimming through water would just be stupid.
Yes.
Oh, actually, that was my mistake. That was the tropical grasslands where the horrifying predator monkeys are.
That makes a bit more sense.
No, deserts are fine. Deserts are cool. You get the desert leaper, who's like a really fat kangaroo.
I was going to say, deserts aren't cool. They're deserts.
They can find the cool at night, Rob. Oh, also, there's sort of a big worm monster.
Oh.
But it's more like a naked mole rat. But it does have, like, possibly the best name in the entire book.
Mm.
The Desert Shark.
You see, that's a promise that I think a giant worm naked mole rat cannot live up to.
So, hang on, if they made a movie about the giant naked mole rat in the desert in the future, and then they went to hunt it, would they actually have the line, we're going to need a bigger camel?
No, Rob, because camels go extinct and get replaced by desert leapers with fat kangaroos that can store like massive amounts of subcutaneous fat in their tails and eat it over the leader periods.
We're going to need a bigger leaper.
That'll do.
There's also a tiny elephant that can climb on trees and eat grubs with its tusk.
See, that sounds... one you showed me before, and I think that's amazing.
That sounds adorable.
It is quite adorable.
I want one now.
I would go so far as to say that sounds adorbs with a full-on Z.
Yeah, it is even cuter than the bendy squirrels.
Please say they're actually called that.
No, I think in what is possibly Dougal Dixon's one misstep, he named the creature with elongated flexible spines Chivits instead of bendy squirrels.
Oh, that's a wasted opportunity right there. If I ever make a rock group of any kind or a music group of any kind, they are going to be called the Bendy Squirrels.
Yes.
Actually, that's a folk group name, isn't it?
I'm hearing them as kind of a sort of lo-fi punk outfit, quite similar to the Lovely Eggs.
Lo-fi folk punk?
Yeah. Yeah, you can do that.
Can their rivals be conventional hard rock band, the Desert Sharks?
Yes. Yes, they can. Yeah. And they do some weird crossover songs.
Excellent. So that's After Man, a Zoology of the Future by Dougal Dixon. Interesting textbook. Even greater resource for band names.
Yes. Oh.
There's also one called The Frog Monkey.
That's an amazing name.
Yeah.
Although it does conjure up images of the French.
Well, especially if you live in Hartlepool.
Yes. A Frenchman from Hartlepool. Hmm.
Yes, but... hold on to your lovely eggs, guys. Still have some more new stories to go.
Yes. And lovely eggs. This, that, what?
I mentioned the lovely eggs. Why, Rob? What did you think I was referring to?
I'm a bit disturbed by this because there's a joke I usually tell to put people off mayonnaise, so I'm worried about where this is going.
Yes, Ryan Gilby has written in The Guardian that the great British tradition, and one that we use and quite frankly abuse fairly often, of the double entendre may be under threat. The butcher Pete Limer has been told to tone down his signs, including steak on offer, have your rump tenderised before you leave, as well as more, it has to be said, baleful stuff about big-breasted birds and a big fresh cock.
Okay.
So that's what Sid James is doing nowadays.
The rump tenderised.
You know, he's not busy being dead.
Yeah. The rump tenderised, that one I'm fine with, but...
The rest are stretching, isn't it? Apparently there's also one about a horny sausage, which doesn't even work.
Exactly.
No, that's... You've let me down, butchers, there.
Nobody would independently describe a sausage as horny. The pleasure of an innuendo comes from the fleeting possibility that it might be unintentional.
Well, here's the thing about this article, and Andrew will remember this. Do you remember the Exeter book, Andrew? Do you remember the riddles in the Exeter book?
Oh, yeah, I think I do too, actually.
Were they the ones that were really rubbish and definitely weren't riddles?
Yeah, they definitely weren't riddles. You know, like, what is stiff and hard and hangs by the thigh of a man? and fits perfectly into a special hall. Obviously a key.
Yes. Yes. School children would be ashamed of that one.
I think that was our episode called Anglo-Saxon Trolling. So yeah, the double entendre, it's like a 1,000-year-old tradition in this country.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, it goes back to Chaucer.
Yeah. There's a lot of it in the Canterbury Tales.
Yeah. Even the title of a Shakespeare play is a double entendre, although it doesn't work now, which is why it gets taught in schools. Do you know which one that is?
Which one?
Much Ado About Nothing.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. How could I forget?
Nothing. Yeah, nothing back then was a euphemism for a lady's part.
Because yep. She's got no thing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Truly, he was one of the greats.
They have a Blackadder quote on there, don't they?
They do, when he's led away to the firing squad, and one of the executioners says, "I've got to say, Captain, I've got to admire your balls."
And what's the reply?
Maybe later. It's not even the best double entendre in Blackadder, which I think goes to Captain Redbeard Rum talking about how during a storm his ship was full of anguished sailors tossing throughout the night.
Yes.
In fact, is it a rule of thumb that every single double entendre is made better by involving sailors?
I don't know. I think there's just something about a group of tightly packed seamen that makes it all the funnier.
I'm not sure, because that article does have an E17 thing on there as well.
It does, yes. Yeah, I'll butter the toast if you lick the knife.
That's just horrible.
Just, what would you
yeah.
eat? I would to lick the butter off. It's a, butter on its own just isn't very nice.
Nope.
It's, I mean, yeah, and they've missed the opportunity to both make it make more sense and use one of the most suggestive food names there is, with jam.
Just smear a bit of jam on my crumpet.
Yes. Oh, yep. Dear.
See, that's just, I don't even know what that's a double entendre for, but it sounds so dirty.
Yeah. And the thing is, it's just the way we work now. I mean, I will admit I am guilty of giggling at everything, because it just, most things people say sound like a double entendre to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a shame you've been saddled with that curse. It's a real bum rap.
Yeah, see? I'm just sitting here, just poker face. Poker face.
But only if she asks you to first.
Again.
Okay, quick fire round. What is everyone's favourite double entendre?
Oh, now you're asking.
I don't know. I mean, I tend to just like whatever fits best in the given situation.
Yeah.
Is what she said. I mean, really, the good, that's what she said. You can't go wrong with.
I have a great soft spot, and I think I've told Andrew this before, the Julian Sandy sketches that Kenneth Williams did on Round the Horn in 1950. Before the decriminalisation of homosexuality in Britain, which is why this is so wonderful and so subversive, that in one episode, Julian and Sandy were approached by someone who wanted them to represent him in court. And Williams asked, is it a civil case? And the man said yes, to which Williams replies, "Oh, well, I'm afraid we won't be able to take it. Julian and I have a criminal practice that takes up most of our time."
Yes, you mentioned that one before. That's top notch. But also good news, I found an absolute cracker from Dorothy Parker.
Oh.
So question, what's the difference between an enzyme and a hormone?
You can't hear
an enzyme.
Top notch is a fairly filthy phrase, really, isn't it, as well?
Yeah. Yes, it is. I'm still trying to think. There's just, I don't know.
Oh, actually, I did hear a very, very good filthy one the other day.
Mm-hmm.
I had a friend who used to have a problem with premature ejaculation. He's better now, but for a while there, it was touch and go.
I think some of the best ones that I've heard, there's been some cockers from like commentary, you know, football commentary and sports commentary in general. Mm. Whenever you have a commentator, there's been something happening on the pitch and he goes, "Nice tackle." Like,
yes.
What was it? There was a horse racing commentator one time. That's like a fantastic horse. I once rode her mother. I'm like, so yeah. Golf's a great one as well.
Mm.
Oh, it's gone right in the hole.
Mark and Lard, who I absolutely adore, used to have a regular segment called Fat Harry White, which was basically just Mark Riley fed through a silly deep voice machine, telling apparently innocuous stories about his everyday life that were always completely filthy. The one that stuck with me the most was when he went into Fat Larry's kitchen and found him he'd just been out shopping, and he just caught him as he emptied his massive sack into the sink, making a strong smell of onions around the place.
I've just found this, and I forgot about this, but this made me fall off my chair when I heard this. Nick Faldo, golfer, yeah. He used to have a caddy called Fanny Sunnison, right?
Right.
And during one of the golfing tournaments, the commentator, Ken Brown, said, "Some weeks Nick likes to use Fanny, other weeks he prefers to do it by himself."
You've just reminded me that my school days were enlivened greatly when I learned that John Keats had a mistress called Fanny Braun, which sounds like a lesbian weightlifter.
Oh, anyway.
We've accidentally created a great segue here, because one of the highlights of last night's TV was a Swedish man in very tight trousers begging you to dance him off.
Yes.
It was Eurovision time.
Yeah.
Oh boy, was it.
I mean, we'll get on to general favourites and least favourites soon, but I think for have a literary loitering, patented, dramatic reading of the profound and indeed searing lyrics to the winner, Toy by Netta Barzilai.
Yeah.
From Israel.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by this thing because I completely didn't realize Eurovision was on last night, and so yeah. I have only seen this right before we started recording, and I was horrified and disturbed by what I saw.
It's quite a culture shock, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's not so much a shock as a face punch.
I'm going to push them out and say that maybe Japan is not going to be the next country to join the Eurovision Song Contest.
Yeah.
I think they would be justified in actually waging preemptive war against us for this.
Well, they already have enough problems with Avril Lavigne doing that weird thing that starts off, "Minasan kawaii desu."
Oh, boy, yeah. But, yeah, Toy, and pleasingly, we found this on the website Genius, which means that it's annotated. But I think don't be scared away by the academic level of discourse. I think you can enjoy the song's powerful imagery on its own terms. Re, ouch, hey, hmm, la. 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 Re, ouch, hey, hmm, la.
It's exciting. You don't know if the hey and the hum are going to be in it or not. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're missing. It's a real roller coaster of an opening lyric.
Look at me. I'm a beautiful creature. I don't care about your modern time preachers. Welcome, boys. Too much noise. I will teach you. Pam pam pahu, turam pam pahu. Hey, I think you forgot how to play. My teddy bear's running away. This Barbie's got something to say. Hey, hey, hey. Hey. My Simon says, leave me alone. I'm taking my Pikachu home. You're stupid, just like your smartphone. Wonder Woman, don't you ever forget. You're divine, and he's a backer, 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 boy, backer, 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 I'm not your backer. Mm-hmm. Backer. Mm-hmm. Backer. Mm-hmm. I'm not your toy. Not your toy. Your stupid boy. Stupid boy. I'll make you watch me dancing with my dolls on the Mother Booker beat. She definitely said Booker, by the way. Not your toy.
Why did she?
Not your toy. Kaloo, 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 kaloo. Ah, ah, ah. I need little booba. Don't you go and play with me, boy. Ah, ah, ah. I need little boo play. Shake, kaloo, kaloo. Wedding bells ringing. Kaloo, kaloo. Money men, bling, bling. I don't care about your Steffa baby. Pam, pam, pahoo. Taram, pam, pahoo.
It does sound like she's suddenly farting in the middle there.
I've got to admit, listeners, after that, it becomes a bit repetitive.
Yeah. Oh, that is a shame.
As I said, it is on Genius, so we do have these extraordinary user-generated annotations. And in case, listeners, you were wondering, what does she mean by re-how-che-hm-la? Fortunately, we do have an explanation. These sounds could have a deeper meaning. At first, she's happy. Re. Secondly, she's hurt in her feelings. Ouch. She's angry. We've all been angry and said, hey, right, it's just what people do. Then, she's frustrated. Finally, the la sounds like a reset, a dismissal of the last three emotions. She's repeating them over and over, as if she was stuck in an endless cycle.
I just want
to... Or as if she's realised there's a minimum time limit for a Eurovision song.
Yeah. I just want to point out that Hey doesn't have to be angry because, hey, there's that song, Hey Ya, which definitely isn't an angry song.
Yeah, I do not see the deep well of frustration in Hey Ya.
I also want to point out...
Actually, I think you'll find that Hey Ya is about the slow dissolution of a long-term relationship when both parties realise that they just have no idea how to make it work.
I want to know when...
But y'all don't want to hear me, you just want to dance.
Yeah, I want to know when it became okay to culturally appropriate another country and use it in your song, because lines like, he's a baka, mm-hmm, baka, 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 mm-hmm, boy. Baka is the Japanese word for idiot, so why not just say he's an idiot boy?
I did not know that. I am finding out through Genius that some of these sounds that I have just been mocking are in, you know, Hebrew. So, you know, I cannot, with a clear conscience, criticise her for being disrespectful towards the culture of Japan because I've just done it to her.
Well, it's okay,
then I'll do it instead because she definitely is. And also, surely the point of the whole Mother Booker thing is that Baka from the beautiful, complex Japanese language sounds a bit like a sound what a chicken makes.
Yeah.
to sort of put this in context for people who were lucky enough not to see it, she was dressed in second album Eva Björk with like shelves full of those cats that lower their paw.
Oh, the look cats. Her.
Yeah.
When she started saying, my teddy bear's running away, the Barbie got something to say, Simon says, leave me alone, I'm taking my Pikachu home. As soon as the Pikachu bit came in, I thought, I'm out.
There's no way that anyone can be taken seriously while talking about Pikachu.
But it
yeah, because everyone knows the best Pokemon is Psyduck.
But it does prove my point, Andrew. Yeah, it does prove my point, Andrew. Remember... We did that news story on The Geek Show about how the makers of Pokemon Go have got people to basically clean up just by doing incentives on Pokemon Go. And you can use, I said, you can use Pokemon to make people do anything these days.
Yeah.
She got Pokemon in here. She won Eurovision.
Case closed.
Scientifically proven now.
So what you're saying is if I enter Eurovision 2019 and just do the Pokemon rap.
You'll win, yeah.
Guaranteed.
You'll win, hands down. Not only that, it probably...
But what if I do my new and improved version where it's just Psyduck 151 times?
It might... You might win. Never know. Given how the Pulitzer's going, you know. but not only that, maybe you can win an Oscar if you have, like, random Pokemon just appearing throughout your movie?
I could get the EGOT.
Which is not a Pokemon, although it does sound like one.
Yeah, but what if his movie was called Get the EGOT?
Yes.
That sounds like an Oscar-winning movie, doesn't it?
Yeah. What if that thing from The Shape of Water is a Pokemon? And yet.
This is a possibility.
That's why it's so receptive to human commands.
Yes. That's why Sally Hawkins was so eager to catch them all.
The Fishman used Hardin. It's super effective. I mean, that's something we didn't mention. Pokemon often gets overlooked as just the smuttiest game around.
It is.
I was going to say, yeah, this is what we sound like when we finished talking about double entendres.
Yeah. Pokemon is very, very smutty.
So, Graham, who else did you like in Eurovision?
Well, I had a great soft spot for the Slovenian entry, which I thought was almost cheating in that they'd sent someone with actual charisma and stage presence to sing their song, which you're not allowed to do in Eurovision. I also thought that the first one, the Ukrainian entry, which none of the national juries liked, but when the audience score was added, it went right up to the middle of the board. And I think that's
right. Of course
right.
It did. Because he was a vampire that came out of his piano coffin and then set the stage on fire.
He was a high-energy goth. Who knew they existed? You can't name another one. It was a groundbreaking piece of television.
I was going to go Abby Shuto from NCIS, but I realised she's not real.
My least favourite one was the German one who got like massive sympathy votes because he said he wrote the song for his dead dad, but then he started playing and it was just Someone Like You by Adele. That was literally just it. He just changed the words.
Wow.
Oh my God. But he was also ginger. Do you think this was Germany's revolutionary new tactic to just make a clone of Adele and Ed Sheeran?
No, I'm just... Hang on. He wrote the song for his dead dad, and it's basically Someone Like You, which has the line, "Never mind, I'll find someone like you." So he's basically telling his dad...
I'll find a substitute dad. I'm going to go down the pound and get myself a new dad. I thought it was disgraceful. You can't just rip off someone else's song like that.
I thought it was disgraceful. You can't just go down the pound and get yourself a new dad.
There was a lot of people who were trying to be more seriousness than Eurovision really can bear. I thought the French entry, which was about the refugee crisis, was a nice song. But that Italian one that ended the night...
Everything is bad.
Yeah, yes, that was dreadful.
Hey, Eurovision, we've all had some fun tonight, but what about that terrorism? What's going on?
Here are the two least stylish things to come out of Italy since Berlusconi's hair plugs to make you feel guilty about all of that.
Also, didn't they say like their song was inspired by the Manchester bombing?
Yeah.
That thing that they weren't at.
No, it's not much of a story, is it? I was inspired by reading a sad thing in the papers.
That being said, I did very much appreciate the way that the French couple looked exactly like the villains from a 1980s sports movie.
There were some amazing sort of people trying to look like other things, like the Serbian entry began with Dr. Jacoby from Twin Peaks on flute.
What?
Oh yes, and then cut to General Zod and his three sister wives.
Yes.
See, I normally love watching Eurovision just for this kind of thing, and I'm kind of sad that I missed it yesterday.
I also really like the Albanians' outfits.
Oh, which ones were they?
The Albanians were the Goo Goo Dolls, but from the Mad Max universe.
I thought another one that I thought was really terrible was it the Danish entry where they were trying to get the Game of Thrones vote?
Yeah, we are Vikings and we're going to do some walking about.
They actually shouted out to the crowd, "Come on, walk with us," which is the worst piece of crowd interaction on a whole night of bad crowd interaction. Yeah, that was pants. One of them did have a big ginger beard, which now makes me wonder whether he'd been like cosplaying ISIS in an Iranian supermarket the day before the contest.
It all links back to each other, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But
there was like, there was five of them, wasn't there?
Yeah.
But like four of them had massive beards, and then like the fifth just hadn't bothered. Like yes. He had a bit of stubble.
Well, that's like with ZZ Top, famously the only member who doesn't have a beard is Frank Beard.
Yes.
So presumably they're going for the same thing.
Did you guys see that Deadpool trailer about Canada and the Eurovision?
No.
I was too busy watching actual Eurovision.
It came out a few days before yesterday. And it's basically Ryan Reynolds in his Deadpool outfit talking about Canada and talking about Eurovision, saying, "Why aren't we invited to Eurovision? You invite Australia, and that's not even on, that's barely on the planet." And, you know, and we gave you our gift of Celine Dion, and you snubbed us. let us into Eurovision, or we're coming at you with mooses and affordable healthcare.
I don't see why Canada couldn't be in. Yeah, I mean, they couldn't do a worse job than Lithuania, really, could they?
Well, let's put it this way.
Oh my god, that was the one in the pink dress, and then like her husband came on stage, and they had a cuddle.
Yeah, it was like the sappiest stage invasion ever.
See, that would have been more fun if her husband came on stage and started shouting at her, telling her that she wasn't allowed to do this. It wasn't right. Society would talk.
Yes.
Thing is, I don't see why Canada can't be in. Australia has joined the Eurovision. Israel isn't even part of Europe.
I mean, and now they're the hosts.
Yes, with their slightly racist chicken lady dressed like Björk. It's so,
I mean,
classy.
Finland literally had backup dancers who were dressed like sexy androgynous Nazis.
Yes, they did.
Oh.
And I thought there were a few where I thought politically I'm not sure about that. Finland's sexy gay Nazis was bad. And I thought the Netherlands entry, you just had to look at him to know that he was a men's rights activist.
So, can I just...
Wait, which one was the Netherlands?
He was the one doing that awful country song.
Oh, yeah.
He just wanted to shout at him, "You were from the Netherlands. Stop trying to be American."
That Israeli song, though.
Craven Bon Jovi.
Bon Jovi. Are we talking like Craven the Hunter?
Yes, because he had a massive leopard print jacket on.
Oh, God. Yes.
It was awful.
That Israeli song, she might as well have called it Millennial.
It was straining for the memes.
All she had to do was, like, you know, Piano Cat and stuff like that, just throw in a bunch of memes from the internet and she would have been sorted.
Just randomly eat some avocado toast in the middle of it.
There you go. Well, now we know how to win Eurovision, Graham.
Yes.
We'll put together our own committee.
Yes. So, should we wind it up there?
Yes, yes, let's wind it up there. Because I'm disturbed by this.
God, we haven't even talked about the edgy rock entry.
Oh, God, yeah, that was disgraceful.
He was so counterculture, he didn't wear shoes.
One of the guitarists sort of jumped into the crowd and had them, like, pass him over their heads. And I don't know, I'm not ready for this level of stagecraft.
They have mastered their art form.
Yes.
He did a stage dive at Eurovision.
Yeah.
Oh.
This is that's just what Hungary is about now. It's Viktor Orban and this.
Forget about the centuries
of history.
But
that's how we're finishing the show.
Yes. Yeah, so that's your lot for this period. We'll be back again soon. All the shows are available on our website, Apple Podcasts, and also so very soon YouTube as well. We have a shop on our website. Check out our wares. We also have a Patreon. If you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter or email us studio@thegeekshow.co.uk. That's it. I'm off. My name has been Rob.
I've been Andrew. Great.
Yeah, that'll do, won't it?
Yeah, good enough.
We'll see you all next time.
Thanks for listening.